the Event Horizon Telescope Network, it snapped a picture of that gargantuan black hole at the center of the galaxy. So it's a good time to ask about black holes and what else is in store at the center of our Milky Way. Here on The Morning Show, I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you can be here. So this is located 26,000 light years away from Earth. We can't visualize that, right? We'll get some perspective on that distance. And this supermassive specimen is called Sagittarius A star, also called Sagistar. Bring it on for black holes, 800-642-1234. Elena Dongia is an associate professor of astronomy at UW-Madison, where her research stretches into the vastness of space outside our solar system. Elena, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Good morning. So this first ever image of our galaxy's central black hole, how significant is this photo?
So this photo is extremely significant for our understanding of gravity because it's the first image that we take of our own supermassive black hole in the Milky Way. So it is important because we know the mass of this black hole in our Milky Way. We know that it's 4 million solar masses. And so now taking the image has, the confirmation that, first of all, we have a supermassive black hole because our eyes finally can see it. It's not an indirect evidence now anymore, but we know that now it exists. And also it's an amazing confirmation of the general relativity of Albert Einstein. That, predicted not only the presence of a black hole, but, the horizon event as well. And so there's a good agreement now between the theory and the observation. And this is a confirmation that, we are on the right track in understanding gravity.
So this image, it shows this kind of glowing, lumpy donut sort of figure. Explain how, astronomers say they've watched black holes like rip stars apart to smithereens. How were these scientists able to get this photo?
Right. So the technique is pretty complex in terms of, exactly how they got the image. But what we see there is the shadow part, the shadow at the center is really where the black hole is. But this glowing ring, kind of clumpy feature around the black hole is actually the gas, which is, spiraling inside the black hole, and it's emitting in radio. And that's, how it is pictured. So it's really taking over a night, this gas that it's actually spiraling in because of gravity. And what is really special about the image is that it was also possible for scientists to figure out this area, this glowing area around the black hole, which is the horizon event. Mm-hmm. So it's this edge, of the black hole where the gas gets into the black hole, but it's it's an area where in that frame, if you are the gas spiraling in, it's exactly where, that gas will take forever to fall into the black hole because the time gets delayed because of the strong, strong gravity. So we are basically measuring here and seeing not only evidence that there is a black hole because we see the black hole basically eating that gas. And that's exactly what, what the image is. But we are seeing, so what is the effect of strong gravity? We are not used on our planet to see such extreme conditions. Mm-hmm. And that's why I was saying that these are, cases that can only test the stronger gravity conditions are basically around the black hole are only cases that we can take in the universe where gravity is so strong. On our planet, we don't have those conditions.
Someone called black holes these huge cosmic vacuum cleaners that suck up anything that strays too close. And I really love that. I love that image. How do black holes form?
So black hole, okay, there are different kinds of black holes. So usually, let's say the usual black hole we really know about are the dead stars. So stars, depending how massive they are born, more massive they're born, more likely they will become black holes. Because a certain point, because of gravity, they will collapse. So the end of a star will be a collapse and will become a very high density region that, you know, become like a vacuum cleaner. So it's really, so black holes are really dead stars. Now, if stars are as massive as the sun, they will never become a black hole. They have a different kind of, you know, of life. But very massive stars are very short-lived and they actually end up in being a black hole. So we know that, you know, it's plenty of black holes in our galaxy because it's plenty of stars that are massive enough that, you know, their end of life is going to be a black hole. However, those are black holes which are, you know, which have a mass of a star. Mm-hmm. So they are usually 10 times or up to 100 times more massive than the sun. So they are not very massive and they wander around the Milky Way, but they're not very effective in terms of gravity. So it is possible that they just wander around, but they are not going to, you know, they're going to like to be like in the symmetry of the stars of our galaxy, but they are not so dangerous. However, and this kind of black hole is different.
I just want to pause right here to reintroduce you, talking with Elena Dongia, who is an associate professor of astronomy at UW-Madison, as we talk about the photo of the Milky Way's black hole and get to your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Lisa in Madison. Lisa, hi.
Hi. Last week, my family and I went to listen to Brian Cox at the Overture Center. And so he talked about when a black hole is going to collapse, when it reaches about 50% collapse rate, it sends out its information and it would go into what they would, and this is the current theory, into a white hole. And if I understood him correctly, that is based on understanding that it would maintain quantum entanglement and that information wouldn't be lost. So I'm wondering about that and what is a little bit more about a white hole and why it's called, what that means then once that information is dumped into this white hole.
Oh, wow. Lisa, thank you for that. Elena, can you untangle that?
Yeah, sure. So, right. So it is very difficult to keep any information already in the horizon event because once, you know, you enter in that area, basically, and, you know, and all the information is sucked inside the black hole.
It's the point of no return.
It's the point of no return, exactly. And so we lose any information about even the gas. We see the gas emitting in the area once it's still spiraling in. But, you know, the black hole keeps light, you know, inside. So the terms that, you know, everything, no information can really escape anymore. Now, the white holes are a prediction. So this is a game theory. We don't really know how to test it, you know, because we lose all information about that. They might be, you know, they might be a way to enter. So there's also theories that think that, you know, white holes are a way to enter in another universe, like, you know, tunnels. But we really don't know because these are kind of theoretical predictions, hard to test. So we enter in, you know, in areas where basically those remain speculations.
Speculations until you're able to get a photo. I mean, I would imagine it's really helpful for scientists to be able, even a single image, to be able to do some measurements on, you know, like the spinning and you know, what's going on with the gas and the gulping of gas. I mean, are you able to answer more questions through this image?
Yes. So it is probably a rotating black hole. But the data are not conclusive about. So as I was saying before, this is a supermassive black hole. So these are, you know, it has the mass of 4 million times the mass of the sun. So it's a huge one. So we don't really know the origin. We believe that basically almost every galaxy contains at the center a supermassive black hole. It's still unclear how they formed, the seed of this gas, how they, you know, how they could, you know, get so much gas inside. Now, about the image, it's not the first image, you know, that scientists had about a black hole. There was one around 3 years ago that was in another galaxy. And that black hole is in a galaxy which is 55 million light years away. And that galaxy has is larger, you know, is more massive than the Milky Way. So it contains a more massive black hole, almost 1,000 times more massive than the black hole of the Milky Way. So in that case, it was the image was actually more clear, because it was possible to overnight to take many snapshots of that image, and the gas took longer to spiral in, so it was more clear to see, more visible the ring around the black hole, around the shadow area. In our case, the Milky Way black hole is closer to us because we are inside the Milky Way. It's only 25,000 light years, but it's also less massive. So the gas takes only 20 minutes, to basically dynamically to spiral in into the black hole, each piece of gas. And so it was not possible, I think, with the current data to take such a clear image like in another galaxy, like M87 that, was taken before. So it's not the first image, but it's the second confirmation.
Let's pause right here with UW-Madison astronomer Elena Dongia, helping us understand the developments around black holes, what scientists can now see about the supermassive black hole at the center of the Milky Way. Join in on the image and what you see in that bright ring of matter circling that dark center dot. 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Elena Dongia here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the dark heart of our galaxy and that new image of the black hole, Sagittarius A star, Sagistar, some call it. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We have Elena Dongia, an associate professor of astronomy at UW-Madison, who studies dwarf galaxies and black holes, fielding your astronomy questions. 800-642-1234. She's with us for about 9 more minutes. So, Elena, this photo took a lot of computing power, and apparently a UW-led computing network had a role. What is Wisconsin's contribution here to this science?
I think it's a big collaboration, and, all over the world. And, of course, Wisconsin had also some contribution to these images, many other institutions around the world, because those are kind of images and science that's hard to take from one individual group. And it is really a big collaboration. And these days, I would say that science is done in this way. It's not just a discovery from one individual, but it's a collaboration from many institutions around the world. So not just the US or just Europe. And back to the spinning, it is probably spinning, that's the idea, but the data are not conclusive yet. So more data has to be taken in future with many telescopes, and I hope Wisconsin will contribute to this again, because we need more. So this is only just the first view, but in order to really see the properties of our black hole, it's required to have not only radio telescopes, but also have different kind of telescopes that look at in different part of the spectrum, part of the light, and combine all the information to really characterize the spinning. So the, how much is rotating and how fast is rotating the black hole, and and the properties of our black hole of our galaxy.
I would imagine a video or a moving image would also be very helpful to find out what's going on.
Right. And the fact that the black hole is closer, but, also less massive, makes that kind of outcome more challenging. That's why we need more data.
Elena, could black holes ever be used as a sort of energy source? I mean, there's so much energy there. Could they be a source for energy?
Yes, indeed they are. Not the kind of black hole we have in our galaxy, but other black holes, like the one has been pictured 3 years ago, they have a jet. Sometimes, they have these powerful accretion disks that, accrete gas, and then, you know, a certain point they have a kind of a injection of the gas outside the black hole. So we see many of them, not our galaxy. Our galaxy actually doesn't have a very massive, supermassive black hole. I mean, it is supermassive in terms that it's 4 million, you know, solar masses, but it doesn't have this powerful jet.
Why is that?
Probably if it had it in the past, and right now it's quiescent. So it's probably in a peaceful time right now. It's resting.
It's resting. Is it possible that a black hole could have had like a role in the formation of the Milky Way galaxy? Is it like a chicken or egg thing? You know, what do scientists know about the connection between how these supermassive black holes form and how galaxies form?
So there are speculations again, because there's a lot of work that has been done in the last few years, but we still, you know, are not all the questions answered about the connection between a black hole and the galaxy. We know that it has a role in forming the central part of the galaxy. On the other hand, you know, the supermassive black hole is not very dangerous for us. We are far away from it. Mm-hmm. We know that it's eating gas, but it doesn't. It has probably a role in shaping, the gas around the galaxy in the inner parts, and maybe, you know, in the metabolism of the gas and the formation of the galaxy itself. But for stars and, you know, for where we are and for the rest of the properties of a galaxy, probably doesn't have a big role. So although it's very massive at the center.
Okay. Talking with Elena Dongia, Associate Professor of Astronomy at UW-Madison, as we talk about the photo of the Milky Way's black hole and the implications on astronomy, scientists working together. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Tina in Ashland called, couldn't stay on the line, and Tina said that in the photo of the black hole, Tina saw a reference to the Holy Trinity. What are people seeing in the image?
Seeing like clamps, which, as I said before, it's an indication of...
You're breaking up a little bit, Elena. Okay.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can. Yes, go ahead.
So what we see is a shadow part, which is probably where the black hole is hidden inside, because it's not really visible. But then the clamps around these, you know, three clamps that it seems to move around in the various images are probably, they should be a ring, but because of the difficulty in taking that picture, because the gas takes too short time to spiral in to really show the ring. We don't have enough images, basically, to really show a ring. We see some like these clamps, they move around. The fact that they are moving around in each image shows that it is probably rotating. And so the black hole is rotating. But as I said before, these data are inconclusive because we don't have enough data. We haven't taken enough snapshots to really make a movie of it and see all the details of the black hole. But it's encouraging that the image is similar to the other image that has been taken 3 years ago from another black hole. And now it is a confirmation that, you know, there are black holes at the center of galaxies, including our own. So that's the encouraging part. So what we see is just a part of the story, unfortunately, not the entire visible feature.
Yes. In the last minute we have together, I'm wondering, what does this photo and what do these developments, how does that inform the research you focus on and the research you're doing?
Oh, okay. I'm focusing on other questions right now, not exactly this one, but to me, this is an amazing discovery and confirmation, because for the previous black hole, we didn't know the mass. For our black hole, because of the stars that were, you know, going close to the black hole and being, kicked around, we knew we could measure the mass of the black hole. So this is the confirmation that gas, it's spiraling in because of gravity. Otherwise, you know, the light that it's emitted from the gas, it would go straight But the fan is so curved, like almost in clamps, that would be like a ring, a certain point, tells us that we understood how black holes are disturbing and they're deviating the space, they're curving the space. And that's why the light goes on such a circle.
Elena, fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us and for these explanations.
Thank you for inviting me. Always a pleasure.
Elena Dongia is an associate professor of astronomy at UW-Madison. And ahead this hour, why some restaurant owners are not happy about third-party food delivery apps. Look at the trend toward local restaurant delivery services. Do you use food delivery apps? Which one and why? 800-642-1234. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about foraging for a Wisconsin delicacy.
Morel mushrooms are a coveted treat in Wisconsin every spring. But the right conditions for finding them can be as finicky and moody as the state's springtime weather. Yet the result is well worth the effort. Writer Mark Griffin takes you on a journey to find that elusive morel mushroom.
Welcome to Wisconsin's premier morel hunting expedition. Is this your first time hunting with us? Wonderful. You're sure to find success, just like I have, exactly twice since 2010. That's when I began hunting these very woods myself. Yep, exactly twice. And no, I have not had any training whatsoever, but that's what the internet is for, right? There's a massive tract of wilderness in front of us, hundreds of acres of trees, grasses, prairie, swamps, and streams. Somewhere over this box of green lie our golden treasures, the morel mushrooms, poking their obscene little noggins out from under the underbrush. And if we search long enough for them, we'll find those elusive fleshy brains. But neither of us have all day, so out of this necessity, we'll refine our search. Under a log, next to a fallen oak tree, a shady spot on a steeper grade where, a few years ago, I had some luck myself. Pinpointing the few choicest spots is what you're paying me good money for. And yet, you will note in the contract you sign that my flagrantly minimal morel hunting expertise does not guarantee success. But what if we discover nothing? Then we have failed. And me, spectacularly so, as your guide and leader. Yet, in that process, we will have achieved something else. We will become accustomed to zooming in on the landscapes in front of us, combing the painted underbrush and thorny thickets for those elusive spongy fungi. We may find the perfect fallen ash to rest. Slowly, everything begins to shrink. The tiny becomes large. The large fuzzes out of focus. That buckthorn, unavoided, scrapes your shin, but refrains its sting. The fly, landing on your hat, is left unswatted to catch a warm break. In the light breeze, the leaves on the farthest branch of that aspen perform the dance they were meant to do on this earth, the shiver and quake. We start to notice something different in the afternoon light as well. Then we begin to empathize with the still undiscovered morel mushrooms of the day. They're enjoying a cloak of invisibility just over that hill, I'm sure, beyond the map, just out of reach. Let them go from our expectations. Let go of the need to do and finish and accomplish this morel hunting task that, let's be clear, could absolutely be completed with the right expertise and luck, neither of which you enjoy today. Do we have any other choice? An oak savanna, long and familiar, breathes a simple sigh. Now's the time in our adventure where I cut you loose for a few minutes to search on your own and... Oh, what's that? You found some? Already? Huh. Well, I guess we'll just call it beginner's luck, won't we? So you did find what you were looking for today, the elusive morel mushroom. Are you ready to go home now?
Writer Mark Griffin brought us that story about hunting for morel mushrooms. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
And now to food delivery apps. Think Grubhub, DoorDash, Uber Eats, Eat Street, founded in Madison in over 35 states now. Should you use them? What effect do they have on the cost of doing business for your favorite local restaurant? 800-642-1234 on restaurant delivery apps. Kennedy Smith is a senior researcher for the Independent Business Initiative at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. She wrote the Institute's report called Special Delivery about locally owned restaurant delivery businesses operating around the country. Kennedy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much. It's nice to be here today.
Good morning. These third-party online delivery apps, they seem to have exploded in the pandemic. They're still expanding. What kind of disruption have you tracked of these apps and, you know, on the restaurant industry?
Oh, gosh, the destruction has been enormous, and it kind of falls into several categories. I think the thing people think of first, of course, is the fees they charge. They charge, you know, upwards of 30% or more of what a meal costs to the restaurant. And so restaurants have, you know, typically pretty thin profit margins. They generate about, you know, 3 to 5% profit. And if they're suddenly paying 30% out of their pocket, that's going to really, really hurt them. And, you know, at least 100,000 restaurants we know of have closed during the pandemic. And, you know, in part, that's one of the reasons that it's happened, because everybody suddenly was at home and had to order carry out or go out to a restaurant themselves and pick up food in order to eat instead of going to the restaurant. But there are other kinds of damage that's been caused too. Like these delivery apps kind of intercept the information that restaurants would normally be gathering about their customers, the kinds of menu items that are popular, which neighborhoods are ordering what are the demographics of people. And some of these apps are now using that information to set up their own dark kitchens and essentially compete with the restaurants who have been their clients. And then finally, there's sort of a reputational piece of this, whereas, you know, if you're a locally owned restaurant and you deliver the food yourself, you know, the customer knows who's responsible for the quality of the food and everything like that. If DoorDash, you know, is delivering your food and it gets there cold or something, the customer is likely to blame the restaurant and not the delivery service. And so it's the restaurant that tends to suffer when the order is out of their hands. They've given it over to somebody who's delivering it. There isn't that level of responsibility there that there would be if it were the local restaurant itself that were making the delivery or in charge of the delivery in some way.
And so that could mean a lost, yes, and that could mean a lost customer in the future.
Absolutely.
You argue that these major food delivery apps, they offer no real economies of scale. And I'm wondering if you can pick that apart for us. Can you explain what you mean by that and what you see?
Sure. I mean, it's a very one-on-one kind of transactional business. You know, it's not like you can ramp it up and make, you know, X amount more money. It's a very one-to-one sort of thing. So there isn't really a benefit for a restaurant in using a delivery app like DoorDash versus one that's locally owned. You know, there's no reason they would go with the big one because there's nothing that they're offering. And in fact, their prices are almost certainly going to be higher than a local app would be because, there's no cost savings in having a big company do it.
Let's look for a moment here at policymaking. Earlier this year, Wisconsin lawmakers had introduced a bill that would stop these third-party delivery companies from publicly offering to deliver food for restaurants without the restaurant's permission. Have you seen this approach to regulation in other areas, other places?
Oh, yeah, sure. There are close to 100 cities and several states that have passed regulations of various sorts that sort of manage how these apps can work during the pandemic. Some of them put a cap on the fees that can be charged, capping them at 10% or 15%, and not letting them get away with those 30 or 40% charges. But many of them also deal with that information sort of capture that I was talking about, making sure that restaurants aren't listed without their explicit permission, because there's all kinds of stuff that can go wrong there. One of the things that some of the big apps have done, for example, is to create sort of parallel web pages. So for example, there's one in my neighborhood in Arlington, Virginia. It's an Indian restaurant called Aroma, and their website is called Aroma Restaurant. Well, somebody set up a website that's called Aroma Indian Restaurant, and it redirects calls directly to a second phone number that belongs to a delivery app. So the restaurant isn't even getting that information. They don't even know they're listed there. And the order is being intercepted. A delivery person goes to the restaurant, pays with a credit card. The restaurant doesn't have a clue. That's not an individual who's just ordering the food for himself or herself. And off it goes. And then they're charging the fee onto the customer there. So, you know, lots of stuff like that has happened. And that has, like I said, had both a financial and a reputational impact on restaurants. And so for that reason, many of these communities and states have taken action to prohibit that from happening and saying you have to have a contract for the restaurant before you can list them on your website without their permission. There's also a trademark component of that, you know, of using their logo and their menu without their permission.
Wow, I would imagine. And, you know, California has this Fair Food Delivery Act, as you mentioned, you know, requiring these apps to have a partnership agreement with each restaurant they list. Have you found what impact has that had?
Well, a really good one, because it means that restaurants aren't being duped or being sidelined in this process. There are all kinds of horror stories too out there about. There was a restaurant that I read about in Missouri, for example, where they had they found that one of the big apps had listed them without their permission. They protested, and it took them some doing, but they were able to persuade the app to take them off of their platform. And then they found that they were actually still listed on the platform, but when someone clicked on their restaurant, not knowing this whole story, they were getting a pop-up message saying that restaurant was no longer offering delivery. There was another restaurant, this one was in California, where a similar thing happened. And what would happen is if somebody clicked on them and put in an address to say, I want my order delivered to, you know, 123 Main Street, they would get a pop-up saying that it was outside the delivery range. The restaurant owner thought that was weird, and so she placed an order herself, putting in the address right next door to her restaurant, and got that pop-up message saying that it was outside the delivery range. So the app was just being vindictive and was trying to punish her for canceling her contract.
Wow. Kennedy Smith with us, senior researcher at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. This is a nonprofit research and advocacy group looking to protect communities against concentrated economic power. She wrote the Institute's report on local food delivery businesses. Join in on food delivery apps, these economies of scale, what app you use and why, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Kennedy Smith here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about food delivery apps and locally based businesses now that have popped up in that space. According to the Wall Street Journal earlier this year, food delivery companies saw continued growth in 2021. DoorDash, the largest food delivery company by market share, reported revenue at roughly $5 billion last year, up 69%. From 2020. Join in on delivery apps, how you see their role in your community. Maybe you're a driver. Join in 800-642-1234. Kennedy Smith of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance studies this sector and is with us for about 10 more minutes. So, Kennedy, bring us to 2017. Grubhub buys a delivery service company in Iowa City and doubled the commission on food orders to 30%. How did the local restaurants respond there in Iowa?
Yeah, they were not happy about that, as you can imagine. And so what they did was they formed their own co-op owned by the restaurant owners. A collection of restaurants got together. They hired their own driver. And, you know, it only cost them 15% to make that all work financially. And it works really well. And that co-op model, in fact, is now sort of being franchised around the country. Communities like Las Vegas and some places in northern Colorado have adopted it, and more are looking at doing the same thing.
What about these co-ops in terms of the safety and working conditions of delivery drivers? What do you see there?
Well, you know, one of the great things about these locally based platforms, ordering platforms, is that they really do care about their drivers. And they, you know, some of them, there are lots of different models out there. Every community kind of adapts this to its own particular needs. But there are some, like there's a delivery co-op in Lexington, Kentucky, which is called Delivery Co-op. And the drivers themselves can become owners of the co-op after working for the company for a certain period of time, for, I think, 3 months. So they have profit sharing, you know, they have health insurance. It's just a much better deal for the drivers.
Is that sustainable? Will that model work in the long run?
Yeah, it will. You know, when you begin to sort of peel apart the different layers of what's involved in food delivery, there are, you know, certain sort of, you know, tangible fees, like what does it cost to process a credit card? What does it cost to maintain the platform, to have the website where people can order and, you know, manage the data and things like that? And then what do you pay the drivers? But that's pretty, you know, you can look at those different components and charge them to different entities. So the restaurant might absorb the credit card processing fee, for example, but it might be the customer who pays for the driver, because it's basically a service that they're buying. It's not the food, they're buying the service of having the food delivered to them. And so each of these local models that we've been following have sort of, you know, balanced that in a different way. So this one in Lexington, Kentucky that I just mentioned, which is called Delivery Co-op, it's a co-op, but it's also membership based for its customers. So customers pay a flat $25 a month, and for that they get unlimited deliveries from the participating restaurants. And then the restaurants themselves pay $300 a month as a membership fee. And with that, then it's perfectly sustainable. I think they had to hit something like 120 or 130 monthly subscriber customers in order to make it work. And now it's growing.
What has happened to the big players in those markets? What happens to the Grubhub and the DoorDash when communities band together like that?
Well, you know, one of the really interesting things is that when one of these local delivery services has popped up, it's like everyone in the community suddenly gets the issue and realize, oh, wait a minute, you know, by ordering from DoorDash or Grubhub or Uber Eats, I thought that I was supporting local restaurants, but now I realize that I'm not, because simply the fact that this one is here and is promoting the fact that it's charging restaurants less, I get it. So their business is definitely dropping off.
Kennedy Smith with us, studies independent business development, senior researcher for the nonprofit Institute for Local Self-Reliance, wrote a report on food delivery service alternatives. You can join in 800-642-1234. Jack is joining us from Madison. Hi, Jack. Go ahead. What would you like to bring up?
Hey, I just wanted to comment. I used to live in China. I just moved back to the U.S. A few months ago, and the food delivery business in China is huge. I would order food all the time in China, and it was so cheap. I think the delivery service only charged maybe 2 or 3% to deliver food. And upon coming back to the United States, I got DoorDash. And I ordered one time. I just couldn't believe how expensive it was, how much they charge to deliver your food. So after that, I've never used them again. I've been trying to stick to just ordering, or to just going to the grocery store, buying my groceries, or just physically going to the restaurant. Even if I can't go in, I'll order pickup directly through the restaurant. I just think they charge so much money to deliver. So, yeah, I just wanted to comment on the differences between countries, I guess. So,
Jack, thank you for that comparison. Kennedy, you know, Jack bringing up lots of good points here. What do you make of comparisons of the U.S. and other countries in how these apps operate?
Well, you know, it's interesting that, you know, for a long, long time in the U.S., who delivered food, what restaurants? It was typically pizza, mm-hmm. and it was Chinese food. That's mm-hmm. what you usually, you know, before the 2010s, that's kind of what we had. And I think that China is a good example, because it points out the fact that if the magnitude of the ordering population is big enough, you really can drive down the cost significantly. And 2 or 3% is, you know, what if everybody were sort of on board with this, it would probably cost. I think that Jack's point also underscores one of the real benefits of these locally based ordering platforms is that they keep the money in the community. They're building local wealth instead of basically just sending that 30% of a meal cost off to, you know, corporation and its shareholders and investors. Instead, it's keeping it local, and that has a multiplier effect on the community in terms of, you know, the drivers who drive there and pay their own rent there and buy their own groceries there and everyone else, the restaurant owners. It's really building the local economy and not undercutting it.
Jack made some changes, as we heard, using the grocery store, going to directly to the restaurant to do that takeout. How should people think about their local economy when using these types of apps? Do you have any tips for us?
Well, I mean, the important thing is to really think through, where is this money going? You know, if I'm ordering from this restaurant, but I'm being charged 30% for delivery, you know, who is that really benefiting? Where's the benefit going? And there are ways that communities can, you know, develop their own platforms, their own delivery services, even piggybacking on existing services that are already there. I've seen several communities that have just tapped into existing, you know, bicycle courier networks and are having those bicycles, you know, now be their delivery service, or using existing taxi services. There are all kinds of ways to make it work that don't involve, you know, having to have a fancy platform and having to use some big corporation to make it happen. So I think just thinking through what infrastructure do we already have in place that we can mobilize is a good place to start.
You mentioned earlier some of these really exploitative tactics that these companies are doing. What about litigation here? Are restaurants pushing back?
Restaurants are pushing back, and so are customers. There are a couple of lawsuits that have popped up in New York State, for example, some by restaurant owners themselves, and then others just by groups of customers who are saying, you know, we're being exploited, you know, at the consumer end of this. So the courts are definitely taking a look at it. Congress has taken a look at it. The Federal Trade Commission has taken a look at it. And I think it's an evolving legal landscape at this point, but I think we're going to see a lot more action coming up in the next year or so.
Is that what you have your eye on here as this type of market industry continues to evolve and seems like it's gaining momentum?
Yeah, I mean, we're obviously tracking it pretty carefully. At the same time, wanting to put out some practical tools like this publication that you mentioned, which is really, you know, sort of a policy guide, but also a how-to guide on how a community can take this into their own hands and develop a platform and a system that really works for them. One of the great things about the local platforms that I've explored and the owners that I've spoken with are that they really adapt them in very innovative and novel ways to each community's particular needs and its personalities. Mm-hmm. And it's really wonderful to see that come through in these, you know, dozens of examples across the country.
Kennedy, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Kennedy Smith is senior researcher for the Nonprofit Institute for Local Self-Reliance. We have a link to the report at WPR.org/mornings. Just ahead, the number of adults with ADHD more than doubled between 2007 and 2016. A psychiatrist joins us to explain why it's challenging to diagnose and treat adult ADHD and a new medication on the horizon. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.